Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back for another malpractice case study review. I'm here with Dr. Mark Leffler, an oral maxillofacial surgeon and attorney who writes these case studies. In his role as one of the lead risk consultants at MedPro Group, a malpractice insurance company, and our partner for the series. Let's begin. Gotta do it. There we go.
Okay.
Audio records reveal flaws in a dentist's informed consent process. Yes.
Yes, exactly. All right, so the basic background with this case is that the patient is a middle-aged man, essentially in good health. That's not an issue in the case. And he is, for a number of years, missing all of his lower left molars. Had been extracted years ago. The areas are well healed. He comes in looking to see what options he has available. A panoramic radiograph is taken. The dentist goes ahead, does a full radiographic evaluation, a clinical evaluation, looking at the patient's medical history, which is, as I noted, a non-issue, and determines that this patient is certainly a candidate to have implants placed, upon which there will be restorations, fixed restorations, so that he can better function. He's all on board with it. At this visit, we'll call it a consultation visit. The dentist goes through the entire process with the patient and, you know, discusses, again, the options, fixed restoration versus removable restorations, all of those varieties, and talks about the implant process, how it's placed surgically, how following that there's a healing period within which time there's this osseointegration process where we'll call it in lay terms, the implant becomes one with the bone. And once that healing process, that integration process is complete, then restorations can be placed on those implants. And hopefully all works out well and the patient is able to better function from an occlusal standpoint. Patient says to the dentist that he's very much on board, and the dentist uses this opportunity to go through an informed consent process with him. And what she does, which is, I wouldn't call it unique, but it's not as common as the opposing situation, is that she likes to record or audio record her informed consent process with the patient. Believing that it's a really good potential defense approach were she ever sued in a situation where there was a claim malpractice, claim lack of informed consent, what have you. But her position is that if I record it, then it's there. And it does not allow the patient to just sign a document with nothing about the back and forth process, and then later say, well, I really didn't know about that. I wasn't really informed. All sorts of excuses that can be used. I was too nervous when I was reading the informed consent document. I didn't have my reading glasses, things of that nature. And she had been doing this for some time, and she would make it very clear to the patient that she was, in fact, recording the conversation that they were having. And just to take a step a little bit to the side, generally speaking, in basic terms, what informed consent is, and as I alluded to, it's a process. It's not merely a piece of paper that has a title of consent form on it. It's a process, a back and forth, where the dentist makes the patient an educated consumer, letting them know basically what they are in for, what their benefits are of the procedure, what alternatives that are viable that might be available to them, and of course, the reasonably foreseeable risks that apply not only in general, but more specifically to them based upon what their anatomic setup is or medical background, whatever it may be, it's individualized to a particular patient. And she does this for this particular patient, audio records, and her recollection is that she discussed with him the usual risks associated with the placement of implants, being infection, potential failure, loss of the implants, And of course, the potential for paresthesia, for loss of sensation on that side of the lower lip and the chin. And that was something that she did discuss because radiographically visible was the inferior alveolar nerve, which was obviously her goal to stay, I'll call it north of the nerve, to stay out of it in a safe zone, if you will, between the crest of the ridge and above the height of the inferior alveolar canal. So she goes through the process as she normally does. Patient says, yep, I understand. I get it. I'm ready to go forward. She says to the patient, great, let's schedule an appointment for you to have the procedure done. Patient comes back the following week when the visit had been scheduled, and he is seated in the room by one of the office's dental assistants. And the dental assistant at that point hands him such a document that I talked about a moment ago, something entitled consent form, which was pre-printed. It was a standard form that she used for implant placement procedures, and hands it to the patient. And the patient said, well, what's this? And the assistant says, in essence, this is what the doctor discussed with you last week. Everything that she discussed with you is on this form. So you just need to go ahead and sign it. And the patient says, okay, fine. If it's just what the doctor told me last week, that's fine. I don't need to read it through. And he just signs and dates at the bottom. So the procedure then goes forward, presumably uneventfully. At least that's how the dentist saw it to be and recorded it to be in her chart. And there's this document that's sitting there. It's signed. The implants are placed. It's all done under local anesthesia. Patient goes home. He seems absolutely fine. He comes back about a week or so later for his post-placement visit, and he reports that he has numbness on the left, on the lower left lip and in the chin areas, the areas that are just anatomically typical for some sort of an injury to the inferior alveolar nerve on that side. The dentist, you know, evaluates the area. She takes a postoperative film, and she sees that, yes, there's close proximity to the inferior alveolar canal. Depending upon how you look at it, maybe there could have been an invasion into the canal. But she does note the proximity and says to the patient, this is exactly what we talked about, that this is a possibility to happen after that. You might be numb in these areas, but I fully expect, she says, that it will resolve on its own. So he goes away and he's asked to come back, and he does, and he follows up. And the reality is that the paresthesia never does resolve. The implants are restored because they fully integrated. And from a dental standpoint, from a restorative dentistry standpoint, he then is as he had hoped for at the very beginning. So all worked out in terms of the goal being satisfied to improve his occlusal function, his masticatory function, but he has this side effect of numbness. And in time, it becomes quite clear that the numbness is going to be permanent. So it's an unfortunate side effect, but it's one which was contemplated beforehand. So the patient gets a little frustrated with it. And as what happens in many situations, there are voices from the side. There are family members. There are friends. There's somebody who you know who knows a lawyer. And they say to you, well, you know, you should look into suing this dentist because that shouldn't happen. So a lot of lay people will always chime in and say things like that. That shouldn't happen. Or they say, I know somebody who had implants and they never had a problem like that. I don't understand why you should have that problem. So this patient does essentially just that and seeks out an attorney. And the attorney does his due diligence, which is gathering all the appropriate records. And having been told by the patient, now the attorney's client, that the conversation that they had at the consultation visit was audio recorded, the dentist had said that to him. So, of course, in the request for records, he requests a copy of the audio recording, which is fair game. Again, I'll take a little step aside and we'll talk about dental records for a second. From the overall perspective, dental records are essentially everything that you have about and for and regarding the patient. So whether it's a traditional clinical chart entry, whether it be electronic or handwritten, radiographs, in the case of stone models, those become the record. Absolutely everything you have, billing records, whatever it might be, that is part of the patient record. And the audio recording is no different. So it must be kept in the usual course of business, just as you would keep all other aspects of a patient record. So the attorney following the request, the dentist does what she's obligated to do, which is provide a copy of all of the records, including the audio file, to the attorney, because there was a request with a patient's signed request pursuant to HIPAA regulations. That's given to the attorney. The attorney listens to the audio recording, engages an expert, a dental expert, who is familiar with the process of placement and restoration of implants. He listens to it as well, compares it to the written informed consent form. And the written form says there is a risk of numbness of the areas which were discussed, and that may, in rare cases, be permanent. The lawyer speaks with his client, the patient, and the patient says, she never discussed the permanent part with me. She just discussed that it could be numb. And I just presumed that it was going to be, if it happened at all, a temporary thing, because had it been something that would be permanent or could be permanent, I would have expected that she would have told me that. And if she had told me that, you know, I don't think I would have gone through with the procedure, because this is very annoying for me, very uncomfortable. It's not what I bargained for. And it's having a negative impact upon my day-to-day life. Even though I can chew better, well, I was chewing okay before, but I didn't have this numbness. So the fact that it's going to stick around permanently is a real negative for me. So the lawyer goes ahead and files a lawsuit, gets a process server, hands it to the dentists. So she has been sued and she is now provided with adequate notice pursuant to the court rules of the locality where they were. She knows there's a case against her. She advises her dental malpractice insurance carrier. And they, of course, do a basic review initially and then give it to a local defense attorney in the location where the dentist is. And this is no exception to that type of situation. The defense attorney is assigned to the case, meets with the dentist, goes through every aspect of the record thoroughly, and first, before playing any recording, discusses the concept with the dentist. And oftentimes, lawyers will communicate with each other. Just because you're adversarial in a litigation situation, it doesn't mean that you don't communicate in a non-adversarial way, especially in the dental malpractice realm, where it's usually a fixed group of people on both the plaintiff, former patient end, and the defense, the dentist end. And they had communicated, and the plaintiff's attorney said, look, there's absolutely nothing in the audio recording that says anything about permanence. So upon the defense lawyer's first meeting with the dentist, he says that, and she says, no, no, no. I do this all the time. That's just not true. I definitely told him about numbness, which could be permanent. And in fact, it's in the written consent form. So, you know, this old expression, let's go to the videotape. And they actually play the tape. It wasn't video. It was an audio tape. Nevertheless, it's played. And the dentist is floored by it. I mean, she just cannot believe that she thought she had talked about permanence, but in fact had not. But she reverted to a secondary aspect, which was the written document, essentially saying, okay, well, yeah, maybe I didn't say it, but it was given to him in a written document. He signed it. The signature is right over a line on my consent form, which says, I have been advised of the risks noted above. And she says, well, forget about the audio recording. This is what I got. I've got this document, which says that I informed him. The lawyer said, well, I hear your point, but I'm telling you that a jury is going to think of it potentially as, yeah, I sign those kinds of documents all the time. I don't read it. I rely upon what the doctor who I am seeing, who's going to be treating me, says to me. That, for me, that's really what it's all about. And whereas a form is essentially a one-size-fits-all, which of course can be modified and made to meet the individual circumstances, the reality is that, you know, when I'm listening to the doctor tell me, I know it's personalized. It's about me. And I feel that if it was important enough, she would have told me about the risk of permanence, and she did not. So this is the issue that becomes at play. This is not even to talk about whether the procedure was done properly or not properly, whether there was appropriate measuring of the quote-unquote safe zone within which to place the implants. That's all beside the point, because what was most important here was, how will this play out? Whereas a jury may not be able to fully understand all of the scientific, dental, surgical considerations of placing implants, they certainly can understand what they heard and what they didn't hear and compare that to a piece of paper which was signed. So that becomes a relatively easy lay task for a jury to be able to evaluate, putting aside all the scientific kinds of issues that lay in the background. How was the procedure done? Was it done right or was it not? And in most jurisdictions, if not all, there are separate ways that a dentist can be sued. They can be sued for doing something wrong, whether it was the procedure or the workup or the diagnosis. There's a technical issue which was improperly or inadequately done, which directly caused an injury. And on the other side, there's this failure to obtain the patient's informed consent, meaning they were not an adequately educated consumer. And as this patient said, had I known it might be permanent, I would have said, no, I don't think I want to go forward with that. So with all of that going on, ultimately, this dentist, and perhaps she talked with other people, family members, friends, whomever, and she ultimately decided that she thought that she could not overcome that, that a lay jury would be faced with this just very, very clear set of facts, which you could not change. You could not interpret them in any different way. The word permanent never came out of her mouth when she had the opportunity to say it, and therefore it's a non-factor in the case. And the patient was not made into an appropriately educated consumer, not knowing that this particular risk, which is a significant one, not only could come to pass, but could last permanently. And a resolution was reached to end the litigation. So that's the case background. And, you know, we can talk about, you know, some of the takeaway issues, if you like. And
we could definitely talk about the key takeaways here. Just a quick question: did she continue using audio on her consents after that? If you know,
I honestly do not know. And it's often the case that you really, in any type of situation where a dentist is sued, the defense attorney is with them for that case. There's this a concept that in the law, it's of course different in all different jurisdictions, but if you take a subsequent remedial measure, so let's say you realize that you have been doing something, and that something that you have been doing worked against you in a particular case, if you make the correction later on for reasons that would, you know, it would make a jury say, wow, obviously this dentist knew that she had done something wrong. So she made a, she took remedial steps after the fact so that wouldn't happen again. I don't know whether that was, it's not really important for the purposes of this case, because even if that were asked, and I don't think most lawyers would ask about that, I don't know that many, any judges, I can't say any, but I don't think it commonly would be allowed into evidence if there were something provided to a jury which constituted a subsequent remedial measure. So it's a long answer to, I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I completely follow that. It's just, it's interesting. You know, I actually mentioned, this is years ago, this might be going back 7-8 years. I just started dental school and I have cousins in Florida who were lawyers. And I had asked them if there was a similar case that, so they're actually malpractice attorneys, both of them. And, but they were trying a doctor about, it was informed consent and something happened. And, you know, the patient's fighting that this was never told to me. Similar, very similar situation. And so one of my questions was, this is why it's related to this topic exactly, is that one of my questions is, well, why don't we just record, if, I forget if they were, they might've been defending the doctor at this time. And I was like, well, if, you know, when I, as I become a dentist, oral surgeon, what if I just record all my informed consent conversations with the patient and I get it verbally and then boom, you know, it saves to a file and we move on. And they said, but then you are confined to the very width of that, like literally that conversation. And any little thing that's left out, well, it's assumed that you never went over it besides that, because this is evidence we have now. And the highest evidence that you have, is the more detailed evidence you have, you get more constrained to the boundaries of what that is, right? So they had informed consent on paper and signed by the patient, everything. But that just, it sounds like with this case, which isn't the first time I heard this, that gets thrown out of the window when you have more higher evidence of higher detail, the audio file, right? So is this common that the written just gets thrown out the window when, would you agree?
Well, I don't know that it, I wouldn't call it common, but I can see from an intuitive perspective that if I have a choice of which of two different things I'm going to give more weight to, something which was rather lengthy document, which was signed at a time when I'm under stress, put that in on one bucket. And on the other bucket, we're having a calm conversation, not on the day of surgery. I'm listening to what the dentist is telling me. I have to look at it, well, which is going to be more impactful for the patient? But, and we can debate and argue which one it might be. But the reality is that what would ultimately be presented to the trier of fact in litigation would be that there is this, you know, this back and forth, there's this conflict, essentially, that one document says X, the other, not a document, but a recording says not X. So you have that conflict. And at the very best, you have a jury looking at this and saying, I don't know which to believe. And that's not a position that you really want to be in. So, you know, it, as you're alluding to, having an audio file or any recording, you know, it can be absolutely great evidence for you
if it's perfect.
If it's perfect. But
it's got to be perfect.
But we're not perfect, right? We're all less than perfect. We can try our best to do everything we need to. Perhaps you can even write a script for yourself to go through everything, but there should be, and there will be, back and forth, give and take, a discussion with the patient, asking what's my particular situation. And that has to be a non-scripted kind of off the cuff, on the spot type of sets of communication. So on one hand, if it is perfect, it's wonderful. It's really would help the defense. But on the other hand, if it's not, and that is that conflict that's internal, do I want to strive for something that's really, really good? Sure, I do, but I have to make sure that I actually hit all of the important points. And, you know, we can, as once you're an experienced surgeon, you get to know which risks, for example, tend to be the more common ones. And you might want to speak to them in more detail. But let's suppose another risk, still a foreseeable one, but not one of the more common ones that you would want to emphasize, and you didn't emphasize it in an oral conversation, let's say that one comes to pass. Well, you're then left in the same situation that this dentist was here.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So like an old kind of adage is, records can be your best friend or your worst enemy.
Or your worst enemy. The more detailed they are, the more holes they can poke in if there is something big missing, just like you said. Yeah.
Right. If there's a hole. So it's like a lot of things in surgery and dentistry and medicine, you know, you kind of have to walk the fine line by giving enough detail, certainly appropriate amounts of detail, yet not putting yourself in a position where you're going to put yourself in jeopardy, so to speak, by, you know, having a real opportunity to miss something. And that becomes a wide open hole to walk through.
Right, right, right. And that's why I was told maybe you don't want to use audio recordings, because that's what ends up being pointed, or video recordings, right?
Yeah.
They end up pointing the fingers at that. Like, well, did you say it in this recording? And if it's a no, it's a no. And that's what the jury sees and what they listen to.
And to your point of video recording, sometimes you might, with the patient's permission, you might want to record the entirety of a procedure that's done. Maybe you want to just see it for yourself later on, show it to the patient. Perhaps you're a dentist who does some teaching. And again, with the patient's permission, you want to show it to students or other dentists. Well, and you anticipate that things are going to go well, but let's say you are video recording it and things don't go exactly as you would like them to go ideally. Well, you're stuck with that. So you've actually visually recorded something that did not go well. I'm not saying it was negligently not going well, but it didn't go well. And then you have that there, and it's something that somebody later, specifically an expert, can point the finger. See, that's where they went wrong.
It's evidence. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Hey, I wanted to touch on two really important questions before we come out of this part of the conversation here.
Yeah.
Can we just review, for my learning, but also for listeners, what risks should you include for any surgical, any invasive procedure, such as a dental implant or extractions? Some of the, let's pick my thing apart. Some of the things I like to mention are obviously pain, eating, swelling, possibility of infection, possible neurosensory changes, possible damage to adjacent structures, and possible need for additional surgery in the future. These are some of mine. Is there anything you would say to include there, Dr. Leffler, you know, as an expert in this? And this is our sole personal conversation. This is not like, you know, I don't want them to take this out of the episode because this is huge education for anyone listening.
Look, you know, if you look at those standard consent forms that are out there from a lot of different sources, you know, it might have like 1 through 20, for example. And I think what you just hit on were the big ones, so to speak. And then I might add to that, you know, non-healing, or if it's an implant, loss of the implant. So there are always risks that are general for surgical procedures as a whole. And then there are risks which are specific, not only to the procedure, but with the patient in mind, based upon what their personal medical history might be. So a patient who had some underlying disease, or who was taking some medication which immunocompromised them. So for example, that patient might be more apt to develop an infection or a non-healing situation. Or if you have a patient who's taking bisphosphonates or bisphosphonate-like medications, that would be something have zero impact on another patient. But for that patient, it's something that you might want to highlight.
Additional risks. Absolutely.
Additional risks.
Yes.
Right. So a list, as you say it, I think that we should look at that as a good foundation, but only a foundation, not the entirety of the house.
Of course.
You know,
yeah.
You spoke about one of those as neurosensory changes.
Yes.
So if you use that phraseology, neurosensory changes, unless you're discussing that risk with somebody who's a trained professional, generally in the medical or dental field, they're going to have no clue what you're talking about. And if that were how it were phrased on a document, or if it was audio recorded, for example, a jury or a judge acting as finder of fact might say, what does that mean? I have no idea what that means. So I, as a general rule, like when discussions about risks or about any aspect of the procedure itself, benefits, alternatives, all of that stuff in as lay language as is reasonably possible. So I like numbness rather than paresthesia. I like numbness better than neurosensory changes. I like loss of taste as compared with something which might not be as lay sounding, because you want to make sure that the patient on the receiving end really gets
understands.
It. Yes. Yeah. Because that's right. So it's, you know, we talk about patients need to understand when they're having the informed consent process with the doctor. That doesn't only mean the language that they speak, but that is a part of it. So if you're an English speaker and your patient does not speak English, well, you have to figure out a way, whether it's an interpreter or some other means, using a translation service of some sort, but some means to transmit the information in terms the patient understands. So language, also level. You know, you have to be able to speak to the patient's understanding level. What's their educational level? Is this patient a PhD or is this patient who had minimal level of education? You know, things of that nature, they need to understand it no matter what their understanding level.
Yeah, it's actually funny you mentioned that. I've learned all the risks, benefits, alternatives in Spanish in order to be able to communicate that. And then I also have, you know, the assistants that they're all bilingual in Spanish. They all repeat or reinforce or change anything that I said or pronounced incorrectly. I'll have to learn it because it's neurosensorial for neurosensory, but I'll have to look into numbness. Or at least that's what I was told. But because I have everything in English and Spanish, and I've memorized it and learned it, but I'll have to learn numbness.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a kind of thing where, you know, you do speak some Spanish, as you say, but if that were the only source of their getting the information in that language, we have to take a step back and say, did he actually speak it well enough to transmit the message? And, you know, I could see potential cross-examination where the dentist might be put on the spot. Well, yeah, you can speak Spanish. Well, let's talk. Let's have a little bit of an exercise here and see if you did get all the information out there. So it's, I'm not saying that would happen, but I'm saying it's something to think about. You're ideally, you're better off having a native speaker of a foreign language.
Oh, be always. Doing
that. Yes.
Always. Especially prior to surgery, going through risks, benefits, alternatives, and questions and stuff. I need someone in there with me, right? Because I'm still learning too, but as a courtesy, I like to deliver it in my language, in their language from me, but then also reinforcement and possibly filling in any blanks, questions with an assistant who's bilingual, maybe even like certified too, hopefully. And then everything on the consent as well. So it's at least three, sometimes four to five, depending on the front desk, depending on if it's a patient and a sibling in the room, and then checking over with, multiple check. It has to be that way, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
But I also feel like, you know, in order to give a good courtesy to a patient, it's good to, you know, try and learn their language. And more than probably about half my patients are solely Spanish speaking. So it's, I don't know. It's just the things we do for our patients, right?
Yeah, exactly. But you're right. Exactly. It's a comfort level too.
Try to be.
Yeah. Exactly.
Another question. Thinking of, this is a case on obviously a paresthesia, anesthesia. It eventually, at least, that's what the patient claimed to be due to the implant placement. If you can, this is solely personal opinion. I'm going to throw that there. What? How would you rank maybe the top? Could you give us maybe five? What are the top three? Say three cases, types of cases that end up going to court or go to litigation.
Overall, not just limited to this type of case, but overall?
Right. Like in dentistry, maybe five that you see to be very common. So definitely nerve, you know, anesthesia.
Nerve injury, right? Yes. That's clearly a common one. Also, unfortunately, wrong tooth treatment where, you know, the right might be mistaken for the left, or first bicuspid might be mistaken for second bicuspid, something along those lines. We see loss of implant as another type of case. In more general dentistry areas, crown and bridge work that is not adequately done. So maybe a long span bridge is made, some open margins, which might doom the entire bridge to failure and remake. Infection, clearly is one. Antibiotic side effects, particularly with clindamycin, but not exclusive to clindamycin by any means, but antibiotic side effects or other drug side effects as well.
Infection. You mentioned infection, but as we know, as surgeons, you know, that you can only prevent infection so much.
No doubt.
And that goes to...
Right. But the question is, so you might be take all the precautions that you possibly can to prevent infection, but not every practitioner might do that. And there might be some who are less prudent in taking the necessary steps to try to head off infection at the pass, or once an infection becomes clinically visible, notable, to appropriately step back and treat it. So yeah, I mean, ideally, you know, you can prevent a lot, you can't prevent all. I'm not saying that would be a successful case. It might not be. But a lot of it is dependent upon not only what the result is. The result is only a little piece of it. If there was some negligence, some departure from the standard of care, which directly led to whatever end product there might be, that's what would have to happen for there to be a viable case. And one other that has come to my mind is, I'll call it periodontal neglect. So it's a situation where you have a longstanding patient generally of a dentist, and patient sees that dentist yearly basis, every 2 years, whatever it might be. And then either they start getting significant mobility on their teeth and realize that one or more teeth will need to be extracted, or they end up going to another dentist, whether they move, change of insurance policies, any number of reasons. And the next dentist says, where have you been? Why haven't you been to a dentist? You know, you've got horrible periodontal disease. What do you mean? I've been going to a dentist for a long time. And if if periodontal exams were not performed and if they were not documented, well, it's harder to defend those kinds of cases because you have a patient's word saying, I don't ever remember the dentist sticking this little measuring tool under my gum. I don't remember that at all. And if there's no periodontal recording in the chart, it's basically watching the periodontal condition worsen over time, no referral to a periodontist or no steps taken by a general dentist to meet
correct that periodontal disease. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
This was the case from last month.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's you know, those are relatively common things that end up as dental malpractice foundations. And oftentimes it's multifactorial.
Mm. I mean, yeah, that makes sense. No, this was a really good review too. Not only the case, but this discussion we have after it, it kind of brings along some of the thoughts that I'm sure viewers are having. And we learn something about in addition to the case, you know, because there's a lot of facts that we can take from this and it's the evidence that's available. We have to make evidence available that we need there. We need to prove that, you know, we went through the whole informed consent and whatnot, but then doing an audio file, like you said, we're all less than perfect, right?
Sure.
You have an audio file. This might be that one case of the week you forgot to mention permanent numbness, right?
Yeah.
Like whatever it may be. And that's the one that gets you.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing with recordings, you know, everybody's got a phone. So everybody has a quote unquote tape recorder with them at all times in their pocket. You know, some states don't permit you to record the a conversation of another person without their permission. There are some states that are one party requirement, and there are some states that are two-party or multi-party requirement, which means if I'm with you having a conversation in a state where it's one-party consent, so only one party to that conversation must know about it and consent to it. If you don't know and I'm with you in one of those states, I can record you. In multi-party consent states, everybody involved in the conversation needs to be aware of it and consent to it. You know, that's, you know, obviously dentists are not attorneys and they may not check with attorneys, but just be aware of where you are before you start recording conversations. There might be other things underlying, which, you know, you might do yourself well by talking to an attorney before you do something like that.
The reason why I ask is, for example, for my own, and for listeners, of course, too, but for my own, like, could a patient be recording me legally without me knowing in a procedure?
There are two questions there. Could a patient be recording you surreptitiously? Yep. I mean, yes. How are you going to know? And
never going to know. Yeah.
You don't. And the second question is, can they be doing that legally? So, I mean, without knowing what state it is, I can't tell you. If it's a one-party consent state, well, then they can. But if it's a multi-party consent state, then they can't unless you're aware of it and you sign on to it.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, I think a little bit of paranoia might be helpful in a way. You know, think about the concept. Somebody might be recording you. And are you okay with everything that you are saying? I mean, it's something that we do see in lawsuits where somebody is recorded and it comes back and it plays an important role in how the case plays out.
So yeah, 100%.
And as your first question sort of directs this, sometimes a person might come in without your knowledge recording something. Whether it turns out to have been a lawful or unlawful recording, that's for another day.
For another day, yeah.
Yeah, but for now, whatever is said by both of you or all of you, if it's multi people in the room, is on somebody's permanent hard drive someplace.
Right, right. Wow, this is important, I hope.
Sometimes informative means you get good news and sometimes it means not such good news, but important nonetheless.
That's right, that's right. Dr. Leffler, thanks for coming on tonight. I know you're away and everything. We still made time for tonight. So thank you for that. We'll have to touch base on getting next month's in.
Yeah, we will. With the holidays coming, we'll squeeze it in, and I'll get you some in advance. I'll get you some ideas of
if you can. If that's
right. Yeah. We'll make it happen. But in the interim, you and everyone else listening, happy St.
But hey, these are going to keep getting better and better. This is a really good one today. This was really good. You know. So all right. Dr. Leffler, thanks again. We'll touch base.
All right. Be well. If we don't talk before the holidays, enjoy. And good luck in practice. Continued.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Leffler. Happy Thanksgiving.
All right. Thanks. You too. Take care.
Bye. Good night. We got a quick disclaimer, all right? Note that this case presentation includes circumstances from several different closed cases in order to demonstrate certain legal and risk management principles, and that identifying facts and personal characteristics were modified to protect identities. The content within is not the original work of MedPro Group, but has been published with consent of the author. Nothing contained in this article should be construed as rules for establishing a standard of care or as legal, medical, or dental advice, because the facts applicable to your situation may vary, or the laws applicable in your jurisdiction may differ. Please contact your personal or business attorney or other professional advisors if you have any questions related to your legal or medical obligations or rights, state or federal laws, contract interpretation, or other legal questions. Thank you.